Interview with Robert Davenport, June 19th, 2007, in Denver, Colorado, by Kenneth Durr.
I noticed that you were a Kentucky native, and you certainly sound like one.
Right.
And I wondered how you ended up out here for law school.
I was born in Irvington, Kentucky, attended the University of Kentucky, and then was drafted during Korea. And I spent 3 years in the Army. My last assignment was in Camp Hanford, Washington, where I met my wife, who was a school teacher. And so when I was separated from the service in April of 55, we moved to Denver, and then I attended the University of Denver to finish my law degree. And the reason we came to Denver was that she was from Vancouver, I was from Kentucky, Denver was midway, and University of Denver accepted all my credits from the University of Kentucky, and we moved to Denver in 1955.
Did you have any idea that you wanted to be involved in securities law or corporate law?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none.
What was your intention when you went off?
Well, just to get my law degree and then get a job, because back in the 50s, and particularly since I'd married and expected a child, I needed a job. So when I graduated in 57, I went to work with Travelers Insurance Company doing their adjusting, and then also handled their workman's compensation hearings before the workman's compensation board in Denver. And then I met a fellow named Woody Pierce, Wooten Pierce, who was in charge of the Salt Lake branch office of the SEC, which was a branch under the Denver regional office. And Woody explained to me about the commission, what it did, how exciting it was, and everything. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I filed my application, and I got a letter from a fellow named A.K. Schottelhelm, who was the executive director of the SEC in Washington, saying they had no positions in Denver, but that they would keep my application on file. So about a year later, I get a letter from A.K. Schottelhelm and said, we have an opening for an attorney in Denver, annual salary of $4,250. Are you interested? I showed it to my wife, and she said, well, you're going backwards. I was making more money. I said, well, let me give it a try for a couple of years and see what it was like. And so April 1, 1996, I retired. Went to work in May of 1958, and they were great years.
You took to it pretty well then.
Pardon?
You took to it pretty well, I guess.
Well, I tell you, it was very, very interesting, and to me it was kind of the cutting edge of things that were, you know, exciting and needed to be done, you know, in the marketplace. I was hired by a fellow by the name of Milton Blake, and Milton was a regional administrator there, and at the time he hired me, the Denver regional office and the Salt Lake branch office had a total of 25 people. That included secretaries, examiners, lawyers, and everything. And then when Milton left, then a fellow by the name of Donald Stocking became regional administrator. And Donald Stocking was really, in my opinion, one of the legends of the regional administrators. Don came to Denver from Seattle, where he's assistant regional administrator. And he hired and trained five regional administrators over his tenure with the commission. Jack Bookie in Seattle, Don Mahosky in New York, Jerry Boats in Fort Worth and in Los Angeles, Bob Watson in Fort Worth, and myself in Denver. So, I mean, the guy was, he could really work with young people, and he did a great job in training regional administrators. And he's quite a legend. So when he left and retired, then Ray Garrett, who was the chairman, appointed me regional administrator. And then in, it was in 1993, Arthur Levitt, who was then chairman, promoted me to regional director of the Central Regional Office. And that's when he expanded the Denver Regional Office to the Central Regional Office. And all of a sudden we had 11 states from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico that we were responsible for. So it was almost doubling the size of the Denver region. And they folded Fort Worth under Denver. We still had Salt Lake under Denver. And so all of a sudden we had about 150 people in 11 states to handle. So it was a pretty exciting time.
That must have been a tough transition, folding all those offices together.
Well, I can't speak for any of the other offices, but it didn't present any problem at Denver.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate over the years because I had a great staff, wonderful staff in Denver, good staff in Salt Lake City, and there was good staff in Fort Worth. And, you know, over the years, Doctor, and particularly when I first came with the commission in 58, there was a tremendous amount of camaraderie between all of the regions, headquarters and the regions, because it was a small agency. You know, 25 in Denver, you go back to Washington, walk in the chairman's office and say hi. He'd say, sit down and tell me about what's happening in Denver. It was a very collegiate atmosphere, a lot of camaraderie, and everyone trying to do what they were supposed to be doing. If I ran into trouble in Denver, which I did in the penny stock boom, Jim Clarkson in headquarters, who was the director of regional office operations, put together a team of examiners from all the other regional offices, sent them out to Denver. So if you needed help, you picked up the phone and called your brother regional administrator and said, hey, I need some help. And they sent them up. I mean, it was a very, very healthy working atmosphere, I think.
So there was no competition between the regions?
Oh, yeah, there's all competition. There's always been competition. You know, your cases the significance of your case, you know, there's always been that competition, but it's been a healthy competition. Mm-hmm. You know, not vindictive. If somebody needed help, you sent help. Mm-hmm. Like Jerry Bosch went down to Fort Worth, and all of a sudden he was snowed with litigation. So we sent trial attorneys from Denver, from Seattle, down to help him. And that's the way the commission worked then.
Well, let's go back. We got you to the director of the Central Region, which is, I guess, where you retired from.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about this business in Denver. I noticed that there was a boom in one of the earlier stock booms, the uranium boom, even led to some hearings here in 55, and you would have been in law school at the time. And I'm wondering if you remember those hearings coming to town, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about some of the peculiarities of these over the counter type stocks.
Well, I think the history of Denver can be basically divided into about six parts. And when I think of Denver, you know, there's an awful lot of important things going on in the SEC, but when I think of Denver and its history, I'm really thinking of what a lot of people call the Wild Wild West. Salt Lake City and Denver historically has been the fountainhead, the genesis of the penny stock market, the mining stocks, the energy-related stocks, and all of that. Back in the early 1900s, that's when mining was king. That's when your silver and your gold prospectors were out here. Fortunes were made, fortunes were lost. Horace Tabor, the Silver King, built the Tabor Theater, that was a senator, rose to riches, and Baby Doe Tabor, who was with him, was just an outstanding socialite here in the Windsor Hotel and the Tabor Theater and everything. And then when the price of silver dropped, Horace Tabor was penniless. Baby Doe Tabor, who had lived at the very top of the social structure, ended up dying at the Matchless Mine in Leadville, Colorado. And so fortunes were made and lost. But that's when, and a lot of people never heard of it, I'm sure, that's when accessible stock was actually formed.
Accessible and stock?
Accessible stock. The mining companies in the early days would go out to the public, raise money, and then all the stock they sold would be accessible. So if later on they found something, they wanted to build a mine, then they would levy an assessment on all the outstanding stock of X dollars in order to fund the operation of the mine. That was the very first. And then in the 1950s was when the uranium boom really took off. That was when Regulation A filings were very, very popular. And at that time, Regulation A, the form you filed with the commission, consisted of one sheet. It was called Form SB3-1. Hundreds and hundreds were filed in Denver. My company's looking for uranium. It was a one-page questionnaire, which we used to jokingly refer to as a license to defraud. It was just a bunch of questions and answers. Securities lawyers were very busy out here filing Reg A's with us. And as you are aware, I'm now off counsel with Jones and Keller in Denver, and one of the founding members of the firm was a trial attorney with the SEC in the 50s, and he quit and went out into private practice, and Reed Godbold, who is the president of the firm here, worked with him, and he said he can remember Allie Keller, who was a fellow that left the commission, saying that he had so many filings to make that he would many times sleep on the couch in his office and work around the clock. And the promoters were very anxious to get their offerings through and on the street. They would slip notes under his door with money saying, "Do mine first, do mine first." So it was an unbelievable time in the life of this part of the country. It is the broker's heyday.
If these Reg A filings, I mean, ostensibly they're about disclosure, I would guess, right? And if that's the case, how do they become this license to defraud?
Well, this was the early one. This was when Reg A was just, conceived and implemented. And they just had this one page question and answer, but the commission quickly came to the conclusion that they needed to hone that a little bit more, and that's when it grew into the Regulation A as we know it today.
No more one pagers.
Oh no. Okay. The Reg A is disclosure, and the disclosure is basically the same in a Reg A as it is in a prospectus. It's the anti-fraud provisions, the disclosure is still there. But back in the uranium days in the 50s, it was a broker's heyday. Brokers in Salt Lake City and brokers in Denver, they're actually selling uranium stock on the street corners. Cadillacs were everywhere. The promoters were riding high. It was just frenzy, a feeding frenzy. People trying to buy uranium stock and the promoter selling uranium stock. And really, most of the companies, after they raised their money, did go out and do exploration and punch some holes. And some of them found uranium, most of them didn't. But there were literally thousands of these companies that were incorporated in Salt Lake City under the Utah law. And these companies ultimately were declared in large part what we call DNI, defunct and inoperative, mm-hmm. by the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And these companies were the ones that were picked up in later years by promoters in the shell company business, because these companies, in essence, had no business, but they had stockholders all over the United States. And so those were the ones that were picked up later, which I'll touch on a little bit. But it was interesting that all the activity basically took place in Salt Lake and Denver during those uranium days. Now, there was some in Arizona and other places, but this is where it all took place. Then the second phase of the Denver history is basically in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s. And that's where we had the exotic securities. That's where the promoters really, really came up with some different concepts. The silver investments, that was a big thing out here. A gentleman in Salt Lake City decided that that would be an excellent thing to promote, so he promoted silver investments with what he called delayed delivery. In other words, you would buy X ounces of silver, and he would be kind enough to store it in his vaults for you, and you could keep it, and then you could sell it at a later date, and everything like that. The only problem was that he really didn't have any silver mines, and he really didn't have any silver, and it was just a massive ripoff of the public. Then we had all
what
of
what would happen to him if the price went down, though?
Well, it didn't bother him. You know, the money that he gathered, he just used. Okay. He never delivered silver. He never purchased silver. It was just a way he raised money from the public. He didn't care whether the price still went up or down.
I guess not, yeah.
It didn't matter. then we had all the animal cases out here. The beaver case. The beaver case was a case called SEC versus Weaver's Beaver Association. Went to the U.S. Supreme Court, denied cert. Basically, what that was, it was a fellow in the Salt Lake area by the name of Weaver started a company called Weaver's Beaver Association. And what they did, they sold pairs of beaver all over the United States and in foreign countries. And these were purportedly domesticated beaver. And you would buy a pair. And these beaver would have little beavers called kits. And then these little kits would grow up and they'd have more kits. And you would end up with this huge herd of beaver. And the beaver could be used to sell to other people. They had a marketing arm where they would sell your pairs of beaver. And then there's going to be a tremendous demand for it in coats, mm-hmm. beaver hats, and everything. It's coming back. So they sold millions and millions of dollars of these beaver. And they said, you know, you can take possession of your beaver and you can raise them in your own backyard, but if you don't have the capabilities, we have beaver ranches all through the West, Montana, Wyoming, etc. And at these beaver ranches, we have little pens for each pair of beaver. They have nesting boxes. They have little swimming pools. And they're fed a special diet that's been developed by Mr. Weaver. And we'll take care of those for you for $150, $175 per beaver per year until you can sell them. So nobody can take care of a beaver. You can't put me in a bathtub.
Right.
So they would take advantage of that. So they kept all the beaver. And what happened was that all these beavers being sold to people, they could never resell them because Weaver's Beaver Association was too busy selling their own beaver to take time to sell your beaver. So these people ended up with these huge number of beaver, and they're paying all these ranching fees. And it was just a disaster. And they really weren't domesticated beaver. They were flying the beaver down from Canada. They were purchasing them from trappers up there at $20 a beaver. They'd fly them into Salt Lake, put tattoos in their back foot in the web, and then start selling them. So they sell them for like $25,000, $3,000 a pair. $4,000 a pair. I mean, that was one that we tried that case in Salt Lake City, and it caused quite a stir because the funny part of it is that a lot of these beaver owners and a lot of the other people in Salt Lake City started contacting all their congressmen and people in Washington saying that the SEC was getting into the animal business, and so that was when I'm trying to think. Hamer Budge was chairman, and
late '60s,
and what happened was all the congressmen started leaning on the SEC. What are you doing, you know, suing people that raise animals? And what it was an investment contract. You put your money in, you bought the beaver, they kept the beaver, they raised the beaver, they were to sell the beaver, and all the profits were supposed to come from a third person. I mean, and so the courts had no trouble finding an investment contract, and the Supreme Court denied cert submission. But anyway, the SEC got a tremendous amount of pressure from the public, from everything. And so Hamer Budge came out to Denver in the middle of this, and I was in the office there. I was just staff attorney. And he walked in. He said, "Bob," he said, "do you have any more animal cases out here?" And I said, "No." I said, "We have no more animal cases." But I learned a lesson then. I'll go back to the more traditional securities frauds.
How did this come to your attention?
That's a good question. I think someone in Salt Lake on our staff picked it up and came in one day and said, "You know, this looks like an investment contract." And I said, "I think you're right." And so that's what triggered it. It was this, because it's pretty hard to keep that, you know, quiet. I mean, they were selling beaver all over the place. But, you know, at the same time, that's when all these other animal cases, they were prevalent in other parts of the country, too. Foxes, chinchillas, and even worm farms. You know, they sell worm farms.
Right.
So that...
I suppose some of your counterparts might have gotten involved in
these. Yeah, other cases, but I shied away from worm farms and things like that after the beaver case. But this was when they resurrected all the shell companies, too. That's where they started, in the late 60s and early 70s.
Now, and why did they resurrect the shell companies? What did they want to do with these things?
Well, the way it would work... And a good example of that is a case that the commission had called San Salvador Savings and Loan. And what that was, there was a disbarred lawyer from Salt Lake City, who was a very smart young man. he bought the expired charter of a defunct savings and loan in Nassau. He purchased it for $600 with an NSF check from a promoter in North Miami. And then what he did after that, he printed millions of dollars of worthless bonds and literally had a duffel bag full of those bonds traveling around the country, trading them for stock in shell companies. Then the shell company would put the bonds on their balance sheet, and then they would use it to obtain money from banks who owned the money. And then they enlisted the aid of some brokers in New York, and they started pinking the stock. And when they got the stock up to where they wanted, this lawyer from Salt Lake City and all the rest of them would dump all their stock on the public and then go to the next company. And I tell you, the way that you asked me a question, well, how did we learn about it? The way we learned about that one was that I was sitting in the office one day in Denver, and I got a call from the police department in Denver, and they said, we have $10 million worth of bonds that we picked up from the bail captain at the Hilton Hotel. And they said, what do we do with them? And I said, let me come over and look at them. So I went over there, and there they were. $10 million face amount of San Salvador savings and loan bonds. They were so fresh that the ink looked wet. But purportedly they'd been issued years and years ago. But they were recently printed. Mm-hmm. And so I asked the hotel if I could go through their guest register for the 3 days spanning when they were dropped with the bail captain. And so I went down the list, and sure enough, I found the name of that lawyer being in the hotel. And another name that we knew who lived in Denver. So we immediately issued subpoenas and got them in, and that was the beginning of that case. And this lawyer literally printed two kinds of bonds, one on IBM cards and some on the regular 8x10 or 8x11. And he would print the bonds in Dallas, and then he had a little printing press in the basement of his house in Salt Lake City, and he would print the IBM cards. They were bonds too. But those were the bonds that he used, and the way he worked it was, in one day, he incorporated 93 companies in Carson City, Nevada. 93 different companies. All of those companies had exactly the same name as companies that were on the books and records of the Utah Secretary of State. Shell companies. Mm-hmm. These shell companies had stockholders all over the United States. So he had a ready-made stockholder list. So they would purportedly infuse assets into these companies. Then they would put out false and misleading press releases, mergers, acquisitions, all this. The broker-dealers in New York would start pinking the stock. It would move up and up and up, and then they would dump it.
Pinking the stock?
Pink. We called it pinking. You had the New York Stock Exchange, and you had all your other markets. But then for stock that was the cheap stock, mm-hmm. the penny stocks, right. They have what they call the pink sheets.
Okay.
Pink sheets. And so they were pinking the stock. Gotcha. And those 93 companies, they used them and extracted an awful lot of money out of a lot of people.
So they go back to these old shareholders who've got this stuff in a cupboard somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and they convince them that their old company's back and doing great, and
The thing is, one of them said that they were going to merge with the company that owned the Queen Mary. I mean, they had all these things, and, you know, the people got interested, and they would point to, you know, that they're being quoted in the pink sheets, and the people didn't know what the pink sheets were, but there's a quote there by a broker in New York. So it started moving up. They buy some more, and when they got it to where they wanted to, and then they were dumping it, then they go to the next one.
Okay. Were they actually restarting these old companies, or were they incorporating? You said they were incorporating new companies.
Yeah, they did. They incorporated new companies because then they could control it completely. And and this gentleman, he called this a coup of his lifetime. There's some brokers in New York.
Do you remember this guy's name?
Yeah, but I don't. Okay. I remember his name well. Okay. He died when he was in his late 30s in California. But he was a very smart lawyer, but he just seemed reluctant to comply with the law. And it was an interesting era. Then, you know. After that, we had, one thing that happened is there were literally thousands of those companies on the books and records of Utah Secretary of State. And, you know, what these promoters could do if they wanted to, they could go in and pay all the back franchise taxes and file a report and resurrect them. So, I mean, that was just, the thing is, we could not handle all the cases that we had. They could, you know, resurrect those much quicker than we could investigate them and sue them. So Norm Johnson was a lawyer in Salt Lake City. Norm Johnson later was appointed an SEC commissioner. Norm Johnson was really a great friend of the commission in the days when he practiced over there. He knew the governor, and so we had meetings with the governor, and then legislation was introduced to where all of those shell companies that had been declared D&I were wiped off the books in a period of about 3 to 5 years. So that pretty well did away with that source of shell companies that the promoters used. They set up their own shell companies. But
was this in the 70s, something like that?
Yeah, this was in the early 70s. Your silver investments, your beaver cases, your Fox Insurance, resurrected shell companies in the late 60s and early 70s. And then the next era was probably what you want to call the insurance frauds, but really that was just a blip on the screen out here. There were some insurance frauds. I think that's where a lot of people got training to cook the books. But that didn't hit us too much. So the really big thing was in 1975 to the early 80s when we had the penny stock boom. And Denver and Salt Lake City was where it all began. That was a genesis of it. And the national media would labeled 17th Street in Denver as a Wall Street of the West. That's what they referred to it. Newsweek called Denver a hot underwriting town. Newsweek also called Salt Lake City the sewer of the securities industry, which didn't make the people over there very happy, but it was in there. But in a matter of 3 years, there were approximately 520 issues filed with the commission and went to the market. The aggregate offering price for those shares was $1,484,547,500.
More than a penny.
More than a penny. There were 101 Regulation A filings, 127 S-18s, and 292 of S-1s, 2s, and 3s. 422 were offered for less than a dollar. 260 were oil and gas. 21 were other energy, gasohol, etc. 17 solar energy, and 48 mining. That was a bulk of the ones that went to the street. When they say penny stock market, it's really a misnomer. I'd go back to Washington and tell people back there this, and they would look at me as if, you know, you're not for real. And then when I would tell them this, that during the period January 1, 1981 to December the 31st, 1981, that one-year period, there were 3,091,807,000 shares that traded hands for an aggregate trading volume of $8 billion, $363,368,000, or an average of $7.71 a share. That was the uranium boom days. Not the uranium boom, it was the penny stock booms. It was something that's hard to describe. It was a feeding frenzy. I mean, all of these brokers out here were springing up, these penny stock brokers. And then in 1982, early 1982, the market really softened. And we were very concerned out here, very, very concerned at what was going to happen to the broker-dealers and the people that owned all these stocks, the financial capabilities of the brokerage community, the penny stock people. And so I talked with the NASD here. The regional director was a guy by the name of Frank Bergfeld. And Frank and I had worked together very closely, the NASD examiners and the SEC examiners and the attorneys at SEC. And I called Jim Clarkson in Washington, and Frank called John Pinto at the NASD office in Washington. And Jim and John brought in 50 securities compliance examiners on one Sunday night into Denver. Jim pulled them out of the different regional offices of the commission. John pulled them out of the district offices of the NASD throughout the United States. These 50 examiners flew into Denver one Sunday night. We met at the office of the SEC the next morning, bright and early. The staff in Denver had put together packets for 28 different broker-dealers that showed their last financials, the last exam report, names of the principals, directions to get to the brokerage house. We rented cars. All those 50 examiners left the office, got into cars, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, we walked into 28 penny stock brokers. And we had teams set up in the Denver office. We had examiners, senior examiners, to answer questions from the examiners. We had lawyers who had already had basic complaints filed if they were, had to get into court immediately. We had trial people on hand. It was the smoothest operation. At 9 o'clock when they went in, John Pinto and I had a press conference and issued a press release saying that this was what we're doing, that there's no reason to be concerned, that we're just trying to not cause a panic. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
It's pretty dramatic to walk into 28 offices all at the same time.
It got everybody's attention, the news media, and everything else. And what basically happened was that those 50 examiners in the 28 firms, as a result of that examination, there were 11 that closed on their own volition. There were 6 voluntary liquidations. There were 6 civil actions and 3 civic trustees appointed. So that was basically the end of the penny stock boom. And then after that, we still had the penny stock market, but the commission basically over the next years brought enforcement actions against basically all the major penny stock firms. Blinder Robinson, American Western, First Colorado, OTC Net SA, Stuart James, and all of them. And all of them are out of business. But that was the penny stock boom. And in conjunction with that, we had a huge case out here called FISTA.
And
FISTA? FISTA, First Independent Stock Transfer Agent. Yeah. FISTA was the transfer agent for 58 companies. A lot of penny stock companies, but also some pretty substantial companies. Had a mixture. So we got a call one night. This securities compliance examiner in the office by the name of Everett Smith, he got a call from a friend of his at the police department and said that they had just completed a drug raid near Cheeseman Park in a high-rise, and they found garbage bags full of stock certificates and asked Everett what they should do with it. Well, Everett called me at home. It was about midnight. And I said, go down there and look at them. So Everett went to this condo, and sure enough, there they were. Garbage bags full of stock certificates. And the person that was involved with the company apparently was suspected of narcotics, so they did a drug raid there. And the next morning, the commission gave us authority to file a civil action. Filed a civil action, got a receiver appointed, and that hit the papers. You know, then all the brokerage community got upset, and stockholders, because they thought that they wouldn't be able to sell their stock, is locked in. It was a mess. They were going to lose everything. So everybody was after the SEC, you know, for good. And the receiver did an outstanding job. We put half of our staff on that case with the receiver. And in just a matter of weeks, he had it all resolved. And then they were able to transfer stock. But it got so bad that, remember Tim Wirth? Congressman,
yes.
Tim Wirth had gotten so many letters, he came out, he said he wanted to talk to us and see how we handled this FISTA. So he came out, and I spent about 2 hours with him going over everything that had happened. And he walked out, and he was very kind. He said the SEC did a great job, and that was the end of that. But for a while, it was... it was touch and go. I mean, with all these companies, all these stockholders. But anyway, there's so many interesting things that happened, interesting cases. I think one of the funniest things that ever happened, though, was in Pierre, South Dakota. And this was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And another lawyer and myself were up there working on some cases. This is either the late 60s or the early 70s. We're in Pierre, South Dakota. Not a lot goes on in Pierre. But we were sitting in the restaurant part of a motel up there having breakfast. And behind us, we could hear this conversation that was going on. And there were three people back there. And one of them was talking about, you know, he said, if we can set this company up, and he said, issue ourselves a lot of stock, and then we can put some assets in it and put out some press releases and, you know, get the stock up to where we can really make some money, then we'll dump it and we'll go to another one. This could be a pattern for us. We could just make all sorts of money. And this second voice came drifting over the booth, and he said, well, what about the SEC? And the third voice came out loud and clear and said, hell, they can't be everywhere all the time. We were sitting right next to them in Pierre.
Wow.
But anyway.
So how'd you follow that one up? You didn't, did you turn
no,
around?
No, we didn't get up. We didn't get up and flash our badge and say we're here. No. Because we're up there on something that's a lot more important than that yeah. that scheme, but it was kind of funny. It and then I think probably the last era that was really significant in the Denver region history is the 1985 to 1990. Which was a blank checks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people confuse blank checks with blind pools. It's very hard to explain this to people so they would pick it up at the time it's going on. But, you know, blind pool has been used for years. All companies that will use a blind pool, they'll say, you know, we're in the oil business and we're going to raise money. We don't know where we're going to explore, what leases we're going to acquire, but we plan to concentrate on the Rocky Mountain region and acquire leases. You know, that's okay. Blank checks in the 85s and 90s out here. Again, this was spawned in Denver and Salt Lake. Give us your money. We have no plans. We don't know what we're going to do. But just give us your money and trust us to make a wise investment. Well, I had a hard time with that one. And I just didn't like it at all. In 1985, we had 138 S-18s filed in Denver. That was an S-18. You know, we used to have just Reg A in Denver. And then we had hearings in Denver. We had 40-some-odd people testify from the brokerage, legal community, accounting, how bad we needed. John Evans chaired the testimony, went back to the commission. The commission said, yeah, we'll pass S-18. We'll put the registration process in the regional office with a limitation as to the amount. So at last we had the registration process in the Denver office. We didn't have the conditional exemption from registration provided by Reg 8. We had a full registration. Anyway, 1985, 138 S-18s were filed. 63 were blank checks. So I tried real hard to get the commission interested, and they just didn't seem to get interested. Then in 1986, we had 157 S-18s filed, and 133 were blank checks. On Valentine's Day, February the 14th, 1986, there's a guy that walked into the Denver office with a cart. He had a cart. And on it were 33 boxes. And all 33 of those boxes contained a blank check S-18 filing. And the receptionist called me out there, and I looked at it, and here were 33 filings, S-18 for blank checks. I couldn't believe it. We called it the Valentine Day Massacre.
Well, who was the guy with the car?
The delivery man, UPS. They were all from Salt Lake City, all the filings.
Okay. These had to come to you. These would have normally come to you. It's just that you got so many at once.
Yeah, well, the receptionist didn't know what to do with 33 filings sitting out there, you know, and this guy was trying to deliver them.
Yeah.
And so they were logged in, getting ready to be processed, and we started looking at them. Really close. We looked at them, and we found that 16 of those filings had the same attorney, the same accountant, the same transfer agent. All of them had been incorporated in the last 3 months. All were headquartered in Salt Lake City or Murray, Utah. None had any operational history. All had approximately $5,000 on their balance sheet. The officers and directors had little or no experience in any business relating to identifying and acquiring companies, mergers, or anything. Each said they were seeking unknown business opportunities. They were all self-underwritten by the officers and directors. Several had common officers and directors. Every one of the S-18s was for $50,000, 2,500 units. The officers and directors were parking lot attendants, waiters, students, Roto-Rooter employees, secretaries. It disclosed that the president of the 16 filings would devote 10 to 15 hours a month to the business, and each of the other officers and directors would devote 5 to 7 hours a month to the business. Some of these officers and directors actually met for the first time when we subpoenaed them all in. They met and introduced themselves in the office of the SEC in Salt Lake City. So, with that, we recommended enforcement action against those 16.
Was it the attorney that was behind all of this?
No, there were. It was the same attorney, but it was two or three promoters that were well known to us. And so they were kind of sitting in the background, and they didn't think that we would find out who they were. But we wrote that up and took it to the commission. I went back and appeared at the commission at the table. The commission didn't have any trouble then authorizing enforcement action because they could see that it was just, you know, something that, you know, promoters were just ripping off the public. So that was the blank checks. That pretty well died down. But one thing that happened out in Salt Lake in Denver is that the Salt Lake office and the Denver office were, to my knowledge, the two offices who first participated in an undercover so-called sting operation. And that happened during the penny stock boom. And what it was, it got so bad that the FBI, the Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney, the Postal Authorities, and the Internal Revenue Service, we all got together in Denver here. And Mike Norton was the U.S. Attorney then here. And we put together a task force, undercover task force, led by the FBI. The SEC, the only thing we did in Denver and Salt Lake was provide technical assistance to the undercover people. Commission was not very comfortable with this whole thing, but we persuade them that it's the only way that you could really make an impression on these penny stock promoters. And so the commission authorized it. And I think one of the funny things was that the FBI sent in a 26-year-old FBI agent from another office. And the way the Wall Street Journal wrote it up was, he blew into Denver in a red convertible, wearing a big Rolex watch. And he started moving in the areas where the promoters moved, the bars, the different places. Pretty soon he was right in the middle of them. And they had meetings that were taped and videos and everything. And it was first done in Salt Lake, then in Denver. But it would, I can understand how much pressure those people are under when they're doing something like that. Mm-hmm. This 26-year-old kid was, he was a nervous wreck trying to play all these different roles. But that resulted in 98 people being indicted or charged in informations. Either indictments or informations. So it had an impact. But
so these promoters, these are people with offices on, over on 17th Street?
No, they were, no. Well, there's some of them on 17th, but a lot of them were in Salt Lake City and a lot of them were in Denver. They were in Englewood and they were all over the Denver metro area, all over the Salt Lake area, Murray, Logan, they're all over the place. And, you know, like CPAs were in on it and lawyers were in on it and had evidence where a CPA was being paid off in $20 bills and, you know, witnesses. It was just a lot of them all around here. It was not your major brokerage houses. It was the penny stock crowd, mm-hmm. And that was exciting. We used to fly to Salt Lake City, and then take different taxis to go to the hotel and knock on the door, and it was like something out of a magazine or something. But anyway, it worked well. We had success at it, and the staff in Denver, the staff in Salt Lake, did a tremendous job. But that's probably just about everything I had on the different eras in Denver here.
Okay. Well, let's go back to when you came into the Denver regional office. I guess was Donald Stocking in there at that point, or did
no?
Milton Blake.
Milton Blake hired me.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the kind of work you did as a young trial attorney at the regional office.
It's so foreign to what they're doing today. We used to swing through all the different states. We'd read the newspapers. We had newspapers from Albuquerque, from Cheyenne. We had newspapers from every major city in our region. This was before, that's when we had 6 states. That's where we got the 11. And we had close contact with the state securities commissioners. In fact, we were members of, not members, but we would always go to the Midwest Securities Administrators meetings. The Midwest was before NASA was formed. The Midwest was out here. This was North American Securities Administrators was an outgrowth of Midwest other. But we used to keep a real close contact with U.S. attorneys in our region and state securities commissioners. And the state securities commissioners would feed us a lot of information because their resources were just so limited, it's unbelievable. And then a lot of times they would have cases that were very significant that there was so much political pressure that they had rather see us handle it, which was fine with us. In fact, that happened in Nebraska. We got a call from the securities commissioner saying this fellow had set up this company. He was selling intrastate, not outside the state. They had information to the effect that he was using the money to buy tickets to the Nebraska football games, cashing checks at the Piggly Wiggly store, living a high life over there. He ran for lieutenant governor and lost. He was trying to pass a bar exam, failed it, and then hired a lawyer to answer the question for him that he had stolen. The lawyer turned him in. He'd been awarded the Knight of St. Gregory by the Pope in Rome. He was a pillar of the community, and we investigated it and enjoined him, and then had a criminal case with the U.S. attorney. But it was just too hot a potato for him to handle. So we got information from a lot of different places. And when I mentioned that we're up in South Dakota, we're up there because we got information about some of these frauds that were going on up there. So we'd go up there and work the case. And the case in Nebraska, I flew over to Lincoln and met with an assistant attorney general, and we spent about 10 days in a car driving all over the state interviewing people who had purchased stock. He'd sold to three fathers at Boys Town, the housekeeper in St. Paul, Nebraska. I mean, to everybody. He really concentrated on Roman Catholics. And in the criminal case, we had two of the fathers from Boys Town testify. And when they testified, it was kind of all over, you know, because who's going to say that the two priests from Boys Town are trying to take advantage of somebody. But anyway, we got it from a lot of different sources. We would we'd go out and interview people in the field, go back to the motel at night, type up affidavits, go back the next morning, have the affidavits signed. And this attorney general that I worked with in Nebraska, he was a notary public. And so he notarized it. We'd go to the next town and we'd get 15 or 20 affidavits. We'd get subpoena the books and records and go through that and put together a case and file it in court. But we watched the papers a lot. People that complained, you know, like one of the things that really started the penny stock, the 50-man task force was that we kept getting these complaints from the public saying that they could not get delivery of their stock. They weren't being able to get paid when they sold the stock. So you know, that's an indication that something's wrong in that broker firm. So we got it from a multitude of different areas, and then divide the cases up and take off. And spent a lot of time on the road. And that was when the per diem was not very good at all. It cost a lot to travel for the commission. That
would you work with local prosecutors then, or would cases generally come back to Denver? How did that work?
Well, the cases always came back to Denver. It's an SEC case.
Okay.
They came back to Denver. But, as you well know, Doctor, the commission, when they bring a case, they bring the civil action.
Right.
Civil action administrative proceeding. When you get in the criminal arena, that's U.S. attorney. But we worked closely with U.S. attorneys and would second chair them. You know, they would do it, but we'd be there.
Right.
And, in supporting them with, back in those days, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, there wasn't much expertise in U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice on securities fraud. they didn't want it. Because generally they were, well, the cases were a lot more complex and longer than a bank robber, you know, a couple of witnesses and a video and you got a case. And so they really didn't want it. So you really had to talk hard to get a U.S. attorney to even touch a case. And back in those days, we had a long, laborious process. You couldn't refer a case to the U.S. attorney unless you wrote what they called a criminal reference report. And back in the 60s and the 70s, we would, after we completed a civil action, we'd sit down and we'd write a criminal reference report which showed everything that we wanted to charge them with and all the evidence that we had to support that. And you go up to Washington, it'd be reviewed and everything like that. And that was when Art Matthews was with the criminal division, criminal office back there. Long process. Now, the U.S. attorney, and even when I was in the regional director's side, U.S. attorney may call up and say, hey, he said, I know it's a civil action, found him interested in that. So you start talking to him. And you can, you know, there's a lot of cooperation here now. And you don't have that laborious criminal reference report route, which sometimes takes a year or more.
When did you get rid of that?
I don't know, but it was before I left the commission.
Okay.
It was before I honestly can't answer that question. But it was quite a while before I retired in 96.
How large was the Denver office when you came in?
25.
25 people. And so I guess most
that included secretaries,
okay,
examiners, accountants, and lawyers.
Okay.
When I left, it was about 150. Now it's much more. We had 150 roughly in Denver, Fort Worth, and Salt Lake.
When Donald Stocking came in then from Seattle, I guess, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did he shake things up? Did he change the focus of the regional office at all?
Well, when Don came down, Don was truly a people person, great leader. And his philosophy was that enforcement was very important. And so that's what he emphasized. You know, his theory was that, you know, the commission doesn't know what you're doing in a regional office unless you're bringing enforcement cases.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know the number of exams you do, how well the examiners are working, or all of that. So enforcement is important. I think it's important for two reasons. Number one, we used to always, like in North and South Dakota and Wyoming back in the 60s and 70s, and that mindset that they had in Pierre, that they can't be everywhere all the time, we didn't like that. So we would send examiners all through up there and walk in and knock on the doors of these brokerage firms in Waterton, South Dakota,
mm-hmm.
to let them know that we're still around. And so they, you know, they weren't isolated up there, you know, at the end of the world doing their own thing. So, you know, you need a presence. You need a presence. You have to balance it to where your enforcement powers do not become, you know, it's used with judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I used to always tell the young people in the office, and I firmly believe it, that you don't realize the power that you have, that when you pick up the phone and call a CEO of a company or call the head of a brokerage firm and say, this is so-and-so with the Securities Exchange Commission, I said, you don't realize the impact that has on that person. I said, so use it judiciously. You don't want to abuse your power. You want to make sure your enforcement cases are well-founded. I always pushed enforcement, but we tried to balance it with with good judgment. And Don did that, and so he brought that philosophy to the office. That philosophy was imparted to Don Mulaski, Jerry Boats, who came from Washington, Bob Watson, who came from Judge Arise's office as a clerk, for me and for everything else.
So these folks you just named, did they start here in Denver or come up in Denver and then go to the other regions?
No, Jack Bookie, Don hired him in Seattle before he left Seattle and trained him. Don came to Denver. I was already here. I've been hired by Milt Blake. Don Mulaski came down from New York as a staff attorney. Jerry Boats was a legal assistant to a commissioner, came out to Denver as a staff attorney. Bob Watson was a clerk for Judge Alfred Arise, and then he came over to the Denver office. And then Don Mulaski went back and took over the New York regional office. Then Jerry Boats went down and took over the Fort Worth regional office from a regional director by the name of Judge Aldred. And then Bob Watson went down from Denver as his assistant. And then Jerry went over to Los Angeles and became the regional director there. And then Bob Watson was promoted to regional director of Fort Worth. And then Jerry left the commission and opened the office, I think, of Arnold and Porter in Los Angeles. So that was kind of the evolution there. Most of, back in those days, Doctor, most of the regional administrators came up through the commission. That was kind of the trend. They came up through the commission, and they've been at the commission for a long time.
Now you're seeing the prosecutors, people like that, coming into the commission.
Well, you know, it's a different philosophy. You know, and all the people that come in are good. It's just, you know, the way things change in an office sometimes.
I'm interested in digging a little more into the relationship of the regents and yours in particular with the SEC in Washington. The 50s, for example, was a time when the agency was considered to be kind of quiescent, you know, not a lot going on. Some more vitality coming in the 60s, and of course in the 70s, the enforcement division almost took over to some extent.
Yeah.
Did you see reflections of that in your region?
You know, the regional office, I always operate under the philosophy, the regional office should keep two things in mind. They should emphasize programs that the commission wants to emphasize. You know, like every chairman that comes in, you know, has a program. John Shedd, when he came on board, insider trading, going to step on them with steel boots. So they all come in with a program, and that's good. They bring, you know, a fresh look to the commission. The other thing is, I think that a region has a responsibility to constantly keep the commission advised as to what's happening in the region. Because what's happening in Denver is significantly different than what's happening in New York, in Atlanta, in L.A. And the commission cannot make intelligent decisions and everything with respect to funding, staffing, programs, or anything, unless you keep advice of what's going on out there. And so that's something that I always emphasize. During the early times when I was with the commission, and even until I retired in 96, to be honest, and I could only speak for Denver. I can't speak for any other regional office. Mm-hmm. We had a great relationship with headquarters, enforcement. That's not to say we didn't have things we disagreed on, but we worked together. We had support. I remember that Stanley would send out. I had some really big cases out here during the silver market time, and I had some people that I brought in that were really high profile, and Stanley sent me out someone that is an expert in that area to help me, and they worked under the supervision of the Denver office. They didn't try and take the case. They didn't try and steal the case. That happened, you know, because you get these young tigers in Washington, young tigers in Denver. They want to grab a case, and the minute they get a case, they'll open up an MOI or open a case on it so that they can have it and establish it. But, you know, that's okay. We work together. Like I said, when we had the problem with the penny stock market, I picked up the phone, called Jim Carson, Washington, and within a matter of days, he'd put together a team of examiners from all the regional offices, two from each one, not so that they wouldn't be hurt too badly, and sent them down here, and we got a job done. Even the commission, you know, I mentioned before, I don't know whether I mentioned it or not, I was really privileged to work with a bunch of what I called mental giants. You know, the people like Manny Cohen and Irv Pollock and Phil Loomis and Ray Garrett and Al Sommer. You know, just mention a few. You didn't have to explain to them why you're bringing a case. They knew, because they'd seen it. They'd come up through there, you know. And they were mental giants. You know, there are a lot of other ones there too, but those were ones that I really worked closely with over the years.
And was this just simply picking up the phone and talking to these people from Washington over and over? Did you get there and
every time I go back to Washington, I go into the office and sit down and talk with them. And Irv Pollock was a great teacher. We would send a new staff attorney, back for 6 weeks to act as Irv Pollock's legal assistant. And he would sit there and be trained basically by Irv Pollock. When Irv Pollock was a commissioner, I mean, he knew everything there was to know about enforcement. Right. He'd been there, done that.
Right.
And he could train those people back there. There was a lot of, you know, cooperation between the regions and headquarters and the commissioners themselves. It was just very healthy. That's why I think that, you know, I was very lucky, because I came down the road at a great time with the commission. There's a lot of people, you know, having a great time now, I know, and you've got a great commission now. But I had a very interesting 38 years with the commission.
Well, let's return real quick. We started out talking in broad terms about the West and how things are different out here. One thing we never nailed down, though, and I'm interested in your perspective on, is why Denver? Why Salt Lake? Does it have to do more with the economy? Does it have to do more with the legal climate, corporation laws, things like that? How much do those things affect?
I think, Doctor, it's the history, the entrepreneurial spirit out here. You know, like in the 90s, in the late 80s, you know, this was where, you know, the gold rush was. This is where people came out. This is where mining law was born. The mining law was born out here. People were rolling the dice, trying to raise money to look for silver. They were being grub-staked originally. They'd come out, some guy that owned a mercantile store would grub-stake a person with food and clothing and a burra so he could go up to Leadville. And it was that entrepreneurial spirit, and it just grew up. The Regulation F, the assessable stock, raising money, and there were so many fortunes made out here. Like I referred to Horace Tabor, the Silver King. I mean, you go up on Capitol Hill here and look at the rows of houses that were built by the mining magnates, so people that really, and it's just kind of the mindset, the do-it-yourself entrepreneurial spirit that has been fostered out here since the late 80s. And we have some people out here that have tremendous imaginations on how to separate an investor from his money. And irrespective of how quickly you figure them out, they've got another one coming down the pike. But, you know, the funny thing is that old saying, what goes around comes around. You know, many of these things that we talked about, you know, the hot issue market, you know, the stables of investor, sell it for 5 cents, make the people commit to buying the aftermarket, and all of this. It had been too long ago that we read about that in the paper. You know, it happened in the East. There was one thing. Where was it? I think that there was a commissioner in March of 2006 that told the Wall Street Journal that more attention should be given to fighting fraud in the penny stock dash pump and dump market. Hmm. That's no different than it was back in the early days here. Pump and dump.
Right.
Pump it up, dump it.
Yeah.
I mean, so what comes around goes around. Refine it, but...
I guess given the way, given that perspective, odds are good that more people out here are going to come up with more ways.
Yeah, that's what keeps the SEC in business, is the ever-changing evolution of what goes on in the marketplace. But, you know, the commission has done a great job, I think, and continues to do a great job, you know, to bring some discipline into the marketplace. You know, with our bumps and warts, we still got the best one, the market. And so I think it has a lot to say for the SEC.
Well, is there anything that we should cover that we haven't touched on?
Oof. I really can't think of anything unless you can, Doctor.
Nope, I'm good. Well, thanks for talking to me.